Well, thanks, Karen, and thanks very much for organizing this program here and the conference and everything and having me here. It's a great privilege. And I told Karen that Franco and I, we are the only experimentalists here, so we are the blurred people who are showing some experiment. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. So, anyway, I try to cover the most, for me, the most important things from metallic glasses right now. What we learn in comparison to colloidal systems and so on, and obviously we show some results for the avalanches later on. And this is a whole bunch of people who are working at it. And on this, actually, the collaboration will be Johnson at Caltech, and Itamar was here during the conference at the Weizmann Institute, and we have some funding from the DFG and from the European Network of Vitrified Metallic Glasses, which is quite nice. So very general, I'd start very general, and you can interrupt me whenever you want, and then the story gets, we have time limits, obviously, so story gets extended or not. Very general, if you look at the dielectric gloss for a organic liquid, for example, versus frequency, this is managed by Lunkenheimer and Leudel, that's over 21 decades of frequency. And what you see is, this is very general, several types of losses if you excite the system. One which is called the primary or the alpha relaxation at temperatures around the glass transition temperature, whatever you call it this way, the liquid, which is something related to the viscosity. Then we have at far higher frequencies, we have what we call the wing or the slow beta processes, which show up here as an asymmetry of the alpha peak to the high frequency range. That is something which I call the beta relaxation or Yohai-Goldstein modes, and I will show you what we think, what we know about it actually right now. And then there is even higher frequencies, we call it nearly constant loss or fast processes. This is cage breaking in the systems described by the mode coupling theory, or predicted actually by the mode coupling theory, and then found later on experimentally. And then we have the boson peak, which is something like the remembrance of the system to vibrations and to something which you could call phonons in a crystal. And this purple at the end doesn't intersect from today. This is just the internal intermolecular vibrations in an organic liquid, for example. So if we want to understand what's going on in liquids and metallic glass, I'll show you in a minute, we have to understand at least the alpha, the secondary, the beta process, maybe the fast process over here, to know what we excite in such a system. And that's the name of the game for us here, to explain a little bit what we know so far.
What is the difference between the dashed line and the bold line?
Temperature. Oh, this is, this, yeah, I show it to you later on. Sometimes this shows up as a real little maximum on one flank, and then in other system, that's actually just in a asymmetry. That's why they call it ring. Sidney Nagel talked about it in the first sense also, but there is lots of discussion going on this excitation part here in the frequency spectrum. We have metallic.
If it doesn't show up as a peak, it's hard to say that it's a separate process from.
We come to that. That's exactly part of the idea what to discuss today. Yeah.
And how deep do you have to go into the supercooled liquid to see the? How deep are you in the supercooled liquid here?
That's all above TG. Okay.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
below. Well, that's also a good point. In this room, we discussed 4 years ago. Jim will remember what actually of kind of processes do we have, and when do we see that. Deviation from the Arrhenius law at the viscosity and so on. Yeah,
so
we can.
You have some kind of alpha, presumably it's non-exponential relaxation. Right?
Okay, if we get into that and from the beginning on, I should draw a picture maybe over here, which I don't have in this slide. That's the viscosity, the log of the viscosity versus 1 over T. And this is normalized sometimes by Austin Angel to TG. So you have something, a TG over T, so high temperatures is here, and you have some number over there, and then there is these so-called strong liquid, glass-forming liquids, which are more or less Arrhenius-like. This is, it's good to put it on, it's silicon dioxide. Then you have the orthotrophinyl, which is the other thing, which is the organic liquid, which goes like that. It's called the Vogel-Fulcher-Tammann law over there. And okay, thank you. that's a privilege to it. Jim is making light here. Thank you. Anyway, and now you can decide whether the landscape, if we talk in pictures of the potential in the landscape, shows up where this part here deviates from an Arrhenius one. There is, so this temperature, 1 over T, let's call it Arrhenius, deviation from the Arrhenius part. You can talk about what we call the merging temperature, where the alpha and the beta process merge at high temperatures. I didn't want to talk about that, actually. I'll show you in a minute what it means. And then you can talk about TG. This is 1 over TG, somewhere at some certain arbitrary number. And in the mode coupling temperature, it's actually around the merging temperature. And then there's people in the material science department. They talk about crystallization noses, like where this happens. And that's it. So I'm talking here, this is around, let's say, this region or below, okay, where you clearly see the landscape already by forming certain configurations in the liquid, polyhedras, clusters, superclusters, maybe even. And this is, and the metallic glasses, by the way, are in between here somehow.
The boson peak is due to the fact that you have some kind of in the liquid,
vibrations in the liquid, which are not just ballistic, but they show up later on. Also in the glasses, there is low temperature physics, which I don't want to cover here. Robert Pohl, Bobby Pohl, and others. Anderson did a two-level system model for that also. Now they think that the boson peak has something to do with vibrations, which are asymmetric. Okay, this is Schirmacher's work, and a colleague in Italy, Ruco and others are working on that.
So what are typical glass transition temperatures for these
I come to that also, in typical 300 Kelvin, but it depends on the composition very much. Mm-hmm. The interesting point of this diagram is this is very universal. You find it in everything which is disordered. So I don't know any example, at least in the liquids, in the disordered system, biopolymers, polymers, metallic glasses, I'll show you in a minute, the others, which you don't have these kind of structure. We can't measure dielectrically because we have metals. So we built up in Göttingen quite a variety of systems to measure mechanical these objects, okay? And the workhorses today is just this very simple dynamic mechanical analyzer, which works with a loudspeaker and have a sample down here. And in the middle, there's a little magnet inside coils. And you pick up with this magnet your phase and your response, the amplitude and the phase of the response. And you excite between quasi-static 0.01 hertz to 50 hertz. A newer machine go up to 300 hertz. Then there are other things I don't want to say. Ultrasound, obviously, 5 to 20 megahertz. Surface acoustic waves, I don't talk about it today. But I will talk about these RFM, the atomic force microscopy measurements, which are locally then excited the system. You can make local modulus measurements. The idea here is actually, since we talked about during the meeting and program and also during the conference about stress-driven or strain-driven, any machine is stress-driven. It's internally regulated. We say it's a strain-driven machine, okay, the experiment. In the real world, I mean, I'm not. Then there is a feedback loop between the strain measurement technique, whatever you do, and the current, which drives the electromotor, or the amplitude of the outspeaker here, so to make it a stress. So there is always internal time clock also involved. And when people say they make strain-driven or strain-rate-controlled measurements, it's always a feedback loop inside the machine which regulates the electromotor. Okay, that's something which you have to keep in mind. So that is what we're doing here. We are stress-controlled. So we have the magnet and we have a loudspeaker and it excites the system mechanically. So this one I come later on. Here we go. This is, was quite some time ago, first measurements on this palladium copper silicon system. So we decide between those which are more fragile in the sense of Austin Angel's plot here, more like a orthogonal, the Fogel-Friedman law, which are ones which have an electron system which is more spherical, S-like orbital, so to speak, and bonding. And this belongs, palladium copper silicon belongs to those, and those which are more for strong ones, which are the zirconium, titanium, lanthanum based ones, which have a different, more orientated bond like orientations in the D bonds and D electrons. And that's one which has different strengths and in what we call strong glass forming systems. Here we do have now the modulus, the loss of the modulus versus temperature. And what you saw just two slides before in this general picture, which is on the low frequency side, and then higher frequencies is just turned over to the temperature domain to the high temperatures for the alpha peak. Tg is around here something. You see the wing coming out down here. There is some losses. And if you measure more carefully later on, we found that there even the losses are getting smaller and smaller. Our frequency here is quasi-static. It's 50 hertz, okay? And you shift with your frequency, you shift, if you're sitting here, for example, high frequencies, megahertz or something, you're shifting now your whole spectrum through that frequency by temperature.
You're not tracking the peak.
I can track the peak also, okay? This is what we can do, actually, but it's not necessary. You could just fix the frequency and shift the temperature, or vice versa, fix the temperature and shift and the vary the frequency.
But in the middle of the temperature range, you just showed us you're vaguely where this little bump comes that you're calling slow beta.
Yeah. We did measurements on polymers. And to show that actually what the type of measurements we did with mechanically, the electric measurements are the same, okay? There are some little changes, how you excite the backbone of the polymer mechanically different than the dielectric measurements do, but that's a little detail.
I mean, the dielectric constant for a metal should be right?
Yeah, that's why we measure mechanically. This is just mechanically. That's the reason, because otherwise we wouldn't see anything, right? So we always use mechanical excitation to avoid this problem. Also, it's bad metal. Okay, now let's try to describe what the picture is, the general picture about all these excitations. And Susan Weber gave a long time ago a potential energy landscape picture, which we try to analyze somehow. And you start at the very low end, when you quench the system into a glass with positions of atoms which are unhappy. I think Takeshi Egami gave a talk here, maybe. Did he talk about that here? I wasn't there. So unhappy atoms means you're sitting not in the right potential, minimum, next neighbors to each other, so they're under stress. And the reason why all these properties of the glasses and the supercooled liquids actually happen are due to these unhappy atoms which produce huge atomic level stresses. So the disorder and also the rearrangement, and that's the cause of all that in this kind of lowest position of the T equal to zero, where the positions of the atoms are located due to this quench. And since the icosahedral cluster in metallic systems, which are very likely to form, they actually are not space-filling in 3D. So if the world would be 6D, then there would be no stresses, actually, and there would be stable liquids in icosahedral forms, like the quasi-crystals, down to lowest temperatures. I don't talk about the two-level systems from Bobby Pohl today. The vibrations we can talk about from Helmut Schober. He gave a talk 4 years ago here, also at that conference. And then I talk about these jumps, these cage-breaking jumps, the strings, and then what we call plastic events. And I take plastic events because we had in this room a discussion a couple of years ago with Jim and others, what we actually call an STZ and what we call a plastic event. and to make that sure that there is there was some wording problems, and so I try to say plastic events sometimes in the slides as STZ saying. What's going on? We need two different qualities. One which is irreversible, which dissipates energy, which is actually the flow of the system and the alpha peak. I showed you the alpha peak, which needs some driving from one configuration into another configuration. So from one metabasin, if you want to say it this way, into another one. But we need a second effect, which is diffusion below TG, relaxation, aging, rejuvenation, and all these things which we discussed also briefly during the conference in the last 2-3 weeks here, which needs a secondary excitation, and this is this low beta process, which is inside, reversible, within one metabasin, reversible, you can go up and down again, you can discuss this aging phenomena in this kind of sense, diffusion, I show it to you later on, what that means with the beta relaxation, and then you have, this is reversible, you can get out the mechanical work which you put into the system by to a certain amount at least, by a recovery experiment in the entropy, and then you need a secondary effect, or a second effect which is called the primary relaxation model, is then the alpha relaxation.
Does it mean that these small barriers are of the order of the temperature and the large barriers are of what?
Well, that's what our French colleagues discussed, okay? Whether you go now with temperature up here, or whether you tilt your barriers by mechanical means down there, is a huge difference. I will show it to you later.
I believe this. My question is, what is the difference between the small barriers, which correspond to beta relaxation, energy-wise, with the big barrier, which you have here for alpha relaxation?
If you discuss it this way, I will try to make a point that actually an alpha process is a composure of small string, beta strings actually. So the energy-wise, you climb up energy-wise up here, up to a certain moment where the local modulus gets zero, and then the system flips over into a new configuration actually. So when you do want numbers or you want?
No, I want just to, if you compare
okay.
KBT with the height of this barrier.
This is about KBTG.
Yeah.
Okay, this is about the temperature
where
the glass
is. Yeah, I understand, but your experiment is then typically done at much lower temperature.
Much lower temperature, and close to TG, I showed you.
What sets the two scales? And now you're postulating one scale for alpha and one for beta, more or less nothing in between.
Yeah, that's a good point. We come to that in the sense, what actually is the length of the string? And how much energy do you need to excite that? And then there seems to be a rule, actually, for exciting 5 of these beta relaxations to make 1 alpha process. Why is this so? I can try to explain in crystalline systems, which have 2 or 5 different gliding planes, which makes one change in the configuration possible without a volume change. And so the range here from one to the next one is not equidistant.
These are supposedly properties not temperature dependent, but these are properties of inherent structure.
Yes. Okay, I misunderstood it.
This is a plot that really...
No, I understand this, but I mean, if you talk about relaxation processes, they happen at a particular temperature.
Yes. But this picture is, first of all, just the potential energy, of course. Yeah. Okay, since we had so much discussion about the colloidal system, I put some slides in, actually, from previous work from Peter Bolin's group here in 2006. And they found in colloidal system some kind of a string-like structure and some kind of this kind of octopus or whatever it is, kind of this issue which they call a transformation then also. And what they also showed that if you increase then the rate of shearing and also in our case the temperature later on, that these objects get smaller and smaller. And at the very end, they all have to be ballistic. At the very end, this liquid becomes a gas, this Planck constant ballistically, the frequency then, so you have the single atom at the end. So there is cooperation going on from high temperatures coming down to low temperatures, And at a certain point, the system freezes into the configuration.
Remind me, this picture shows the atoms that are moving. Is that right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah, I should have said that. This is just the atoms which move in the whole system. And since
this kind of barrier represents more like an entropic barrier, right, than an energy barrier.
That's a good point. We talk about right now only about energy. Why there is no entropic point, actually, we can come to that also. It's a very good point.
But the thing that makes this take a long time is not because there's an energy barrier to it. In fact, there's very little energy barrier to move along a string, right? What
the string
takes a long time is that they all have to line up. They all have to find a...
No, the picture is actually that they reorganize into a certain configuration. And then they cool down, and to move then individually one string versus the other string, it takes some energy barrier to overcome then for that motion, okay? But they're not separated. The relaxation
an alternate
is such an exponential one.
An alternate picture would be that there's some sort of saddle in the energy landscape, which is very hard to find.
Yes.
And so it takes a long time because it's hard to find, not because there's an energy barrier to it, but because it's just hard to find.
The
entropic country. I think that's more what's going on in these sorts of pictures. Maybe what's also going on in yours, but I don't know. But
let's go on for a moment and keep in mind, because right now I'm talking about potential energy only and certain configurations which show up. And these configurations, and this was mentioned during the conference already also, is this work from the Weitz and Spaten group in 2007. And they showed when the shear colloidal system, and then we have certain hot spots over there where the activity, the motion is very large, these red points, and then there is certain strings in between also. Here they're taking out all the other atoms which are blue here, which are not moving much under these circumstances. And then you get certain correlations, they're called actually heteromation zones and also branches, not strings or chains. We discussed, Emanuela and I discussed yesterday, chains. And I bring that picture up, which Don Louis already showed to you, which is just a recent review article from Kate Jensen and Weitz and Spaten. And they see again this autocorrelation function. This is not the quiescence system, this is the strain system. And Don Louis discussed it already, which shows that the whole system somehow at the end has a kind of a autocorrelation. It looks like a equilibrium. We cannot see these, our atoms. It's a pity, but all people who try to do TEM work on metallic glasses and on try to see an STZ, try to see a string, they ended up somehow without success. So what we thought in Göttingen was, let's try a different way. Let's try to experimentally look for this inhomogeneous picture which the colloidal people see here. For example, here it's red points and blue points. And I showed some of the data already a couple of years ago. This is what you call the AFAM, the acoustic atomic force microscopy. If you forget the lower part here, you just have a sample, have a cantilever which has a certain tip. The tip is in contact with the sample. That's your normal atomic force microscope. It tests actually the surface, the roughness of the surface, asperities or whatsoever, friction, surface friction can be measured that way, and many other things, magnetic forces, van der Waals forces, that's a wide variety of this technique. It works with the recoupling of that system then to a mirror and to the photodiode and so on. You know that. We added to that, with the help of Walter Arnold's group in Saarbrücken, an ultrasonic transducer underneath. We excite the sample to a certain way and then look for the bending vibrations of this cantilever. And this way we get information about the contact modulus. So we measure locally with the tip radius in the Hertzian contact model. We measure the modulus of our sample very locally. Not on an atomic scale, of course. That's not possible. Because if tip, I mean, the radius we measure is about 10 times the radius of the tip, and if you think the tip as a sphere, then you have a certain radius there, and 10 times of that is your measuring zone, so to speak, and that's about 10 nanometers resolution.
So what's the typical scale there?
10 nanometer.
10
nanometer, yeah. We have this cross-grained picture there. And that's the first picture to test a system is actually the crystalline, single crystal strontium titanate, oxide system, and that's the excitation amplitude which you get then, and you can fit it with a certain Lorentzian, and then you have a certain modulus which can be calculated from this frequency and the width, which gives you the losses more or less rather easily, and you can make a map. This is very coarse grain already, 200 by 200 nanometer, and you see the crystal as it should be is almost the same. So you have the same modulus, the same shear or bulk modulus, is components of those two get together into one elastic modulus, is rather homogeneous. It's a crystal, it's a single crystal. The same is actually true for quartz. If you now go to bimetallic glass, you see there is a huge variation. Actually, this is again this palladium copper silicon, and that's a certain bands actually show up here already, a certain areas which have a high modulus, low modulus, variation of that. And this is 100 by 100 nanometers, so each one is a 10 by 10. This color is meant to be that we make many measurements in this area, and then we assign one color to it, more or less. So it's not meant that this color and that is really sharp interfaces between the two. So it's just color coding is just more graphics, okay? That's to say what is in this region, and then you have an average of all the measurements and then the other one.
So these are the absolute deviations from the average. What's the average?
I showed to you the average is, well, the absolute value for the average we measure globally with ultrasound, okay? And then you see that's the deviation on that.
But I mean,
what is the
other ones were plus 60, or minus 3%.
60 gigapascal.
The model. Okay. What? So sorry, 60 GPA is what you're saying.
Yeah, something like that.
So you're saying plus or minus 10 on top of 60.
I showed it to you in a minute, okay? Jean-Louis is still here, so he has worked out prior to our work actually a 2D Leonard Jones system and desimulation 2009, and showed that there is the modulus in rigid, which he calls black and soft white zones, also divided under strain. And this is 100 by 100 atoms, much different scale. But you see there is some inhomogeneity, which nobody doubts in the meantime. But and you see that is soft and rigid areas. And you will overlap then in non-affine displacement field, obviously, where it starts everything is in the soft spots, soft modes, we call later on in the case space discussion. And that's obviously the case where the motion starts, where the modulus is soft, or I will show it to you later on, even negative.
But this picture would represent like one of your boxes, this whole picture.
This whole picture will be one or more boxes.
If that's one box, why aren't all the boxes roughly homogeneous? Because that looks like if you averaged.
Yes. It is right. The differences come from actually. I'll show you at the end.
There's another scale.
That's another scale. Yeah.
Is this finite temperature? Or is there
do you remember?
It's zero.
Yeah. Here's the numbers. Okay. Now we plotted actually the frequency of the modulus which you measured over a mean value, and fitted it to a Gaussian, which might be not quite true because we don't have the log plot here to get really nice ideas what it looks like, whether this is a Gaussian distribution in the landscape or not, but there might be differences. But look at the number, it's about 28% width. And it's 105 gigapascal. And if you crystallize it now, just use this material, crystallize now, do it again, and the width actually goes down to 0.22%, which is in the order of our resolution of the measurements, actually, and the map looks very homogeneous. We have to be careful. If you crystallize this material, it shows different orientation of the grains. You have to measure in one grain, otherwise you have different orientation, crystallographic orientations. But at least there is a factor of 100 smaller compared to the width of the distribution. The width of the distribution, of the Gaussian distribution, shrinks dramatically. So in the landscape picture, if you have I draw it later on maybe again, we have a very small width, obviously, for the crystal, only one point in a single crystal in the landscape, one minima, but a metabasin in the amorphous one, the broad distribution. And I bring it up only, this is the loss distribution also. The loss is very broad compared to the crystal, and that's new work actually in this area is silicon dioxide. This is a strong glass, so bond orientated, which means that you cannot have such a distribution of different configurations. And so the width actually shrinks down to 2.9% if there is really Gaussian. those of you who are interested in that, you see that there is always some kind of long range flanks over there, which is something peculiar to us. And also the losses are much smaller in the width, so the distribution is much smaller. Kramers-Kronig relation must hold anyway, so that's okay. But again, this is a factor of 10 smaller than for the fragile metallic glass.
Question. So in your box itself, you make multiple measurements, right? Each
yes.
box. What's the spread of moduli inside each box? Is it tiny, tiny, like 0.2?
Tiny, very tiny.
Like 10% or?
No. It's in this order, actually.
Okay.
It's a couple of percent. Okay. Yeah. It's hard to say, okay, to be honest, okay, because you have to take every time you tip up, find a new position, go down again. The force that is not allowed to be too big, otherwise you have a plastic deformation.
Right.
You have a tip, it's sharp tip. If you have one atom at the end only, then you are in your stress on the sample, it goes beyond the yield stress and you make a nano indentation. I talk about it in a minute, like a nano indentation. But that's not what we want to do. We want to have elastic modulus measurement and you only touch it in the elastic regime. So the force sometimes varies from point to point, okay? And that makes also a difference.
So how does the width of these things change with temperature as you get?
Oh, we haven't done that. It's only one temperature measurement, at room temperature. The atomic force microscope is only stabilized at one temperature. It cannot vary the temperature.
I guess this also changed drastically with the pixel size.
Yes.
Because you don't.
It's what you expect, we haven't done the measurements. Yeah.
Probably interesting to look at the effect of the size of your pixel of this distribution.
Okay, so what did we learn? We learned that this configuration actually, which looks like a two-state model only, is in the configurations which we have is manifold. So we have lots of different configurations in the metallic glass. The width is of the distribution of the metabasins versus its depth actually is our number, because depth is in the crystal ground state. And so we now can try to analyze actually what's going on locally for the different ones, for the strings, and then also for the avalanches. Okay, here we go again to our secondary relaxations. And this is work from Wahua Wang's group in Beijing. They analyzed a whole bunch of different systems. And what they find is that you always get this nice alpha peak. And then in the discussion of glasses and liquids, there's a group in Bayreuth in Germany, Rössler, who said, okay, we have type A and type B glasses. Type A would be some which shows a secondary peak very clearly. And type B is those which just have more or less a wing. And we have an argument now where we say, okay, it depends very much on the alloying. What we do, so little additions of a certain type of component makes the system mechanically very different. So it's could be complicated, but it's, so if you add, for example, the cobalt, a couple of percent cobalt to it, the effect is called microalloying. It's known in plastic materials. Jack Douglas was here 4 years ago, and we stay in contact all the time about plasticizer and anti-plasticizer, microalloying in polymers. I know for you as a theoretician, that's a horrible situation, because a 1% change changes diffusion by 70%, okay, and changes other properties as well. The Caltech group is actually working on this glass formingability by changing composition slightly a bit on that and this to make it really working. That's a terrible situation for a kind of universal discussion about what's going on.
But this is why this diffusion constant is somehow
measured in the liquid. Measured in the liquid, in elastic neutron scattering, Petri and others, okay?
The reason is that there are then kind of Arrhenius barriers you have to jump over.
The reason is, let me show the next picture, and then I can discuss it. And promise not to come back. Here's an example, okay? You can look at this one here. Palladium nickel copper phosphorus compared to the red curve, compared to the green one, which is palladium nickel phosphorus alone. You cannot read the numbers properly. So you add copper to the system, and then the peak shows up. And why is that? And the idea is, when you look at the, we talk about the heat of mixing or the nearest neighbor bonding, so to speak, If you have palladium with copper and with phosphorus and with palladium again, these three elements alone, then it looks like you have formed a very stable configuration because they're all negative heat of mixings. They're all arranging in a certain way like a molecule. If you now add nickel to it, which is plus compared to copper and zero to palladium, strong heat of formation to phosphorus, then you see, for example, that this is the nickel, and if you add copper to it, then you have this one here, a strong peak. The idea is the following. We're talking about metallic systems, which has normally, you think about an S-like electron distribution, which has bonding, metallic, typical metallic bonding. It's not the case. We have strong orientations between the different bonds. And so these kind of systems, which are the earlier transition metals here, compared to the late transition metals, have additional cutters, or we call it cutters and glues. So in one sense, and it depends how the element you choose in which kind of matrix it is. One times you can have a glue between different clusters and form superclusters, which then show up as a separate peak. And sometimes you have a cutter in between, we call it a chain, the string I showed in a minute, is then actually cut into smaller ones, and then the system is shifted over to underneath the alpha peak. So the type A and type B depends very much on what kind of element you add to that and how much actually you have, what kind of is the matrix. And it means you form structures in the glass, in the liquid already, which are then extended or less extended, like a polymer which you cut into certain segments.
What are the numbers, the red numbers meaning?
That means the heat of mixing in kilojoules per gram atom, which is typical for the material science community. Called the strength of the bonding, okay, between the two elements.
Okay. So you say there is something which is loose in a certain condition?
The idea is the following. You form clusters in the liquid. These liquids have certain polymers, okay? Icosaeders, different types of polyeders. And now those are the stable elements, the motifs which you try to understand. And these motifs then form either a common ones and form a very rigid matrix in the background, or you cut them up into certain segments and they are very loose, and then these are the areas where you have the soft spots.
That's the idea.
Frustration is always, I told you about the unhappy atoms. The frustration is always there because you have these kind of, you want to make a homogeneous closed-packed system actually, right? And there is stresses in between, huge stresses, because you have orientations between the different, if you want to sit as a spin glass system, then you have different orientations between the local motifs, and then there is not space filling. Density fluctuations.
The minus sign means repulsion then?
No, attraction.
But the plus is then
repulsion, yeah. Well, this is just the terminology of the material scientists.
Do you know if there's any data on glass formability?
Yes.
If some of these are better glass formers than others?
Yes, yeah. Huge amount of data. The Caltech group and other groups are just doing nothing else and trying that. And
they're saying in relation to the change in the data.
Yes.
So which one is, do you know which one offhand is better? The one with
the one which has cutters in there, where you have actually short areas, its fragility is high. There's a PNAS paper came out a couple of months ago from the Caltech group that showed that actually you have a low fragility, so more or less like orthoterminal, and a high reduced glass transition temperature. These two ingredients actually makes up a good glass forming ability.
Is there any evidence for type temperature superposition in this system?
Well, in the liquid there is some kind of that. High liquid, how close to TG that still holds is a problem, I think.
These two, if you really think think there's just two sort of link scales in the landscape, you know, like the picture.
I come.
Is there really any difference between these two, except that those link scales are a little closer together?
Well, the length scales for the individual strings, which I show you then now, is actually
different. There's something fundamentally different between those two types.
Here's a string. Okay, here's a string. This is the idea of what's going on. This is from Helmut Schober many years ago, kind of a string which forms an elastic follow pool and is a 20 atoms arrangement, rearrangement inside a certain matrix. And the idea is the following. This, if you talk about this microalloy now, that you cut in between different parts of the string and form smaller segments, and they vibrate differently, and they are responsible for diffusion. People show that diffusion constants depend on these kind of 20 atoms rearrangement also, and aging is also an issue which goes with the beta relaxation, certainly. Because you stay in one meta basin and then you just relax and can come up and forward again, is this reversible? And so the idea of this string is actually that there is some movement in the atoms, small movement of individual atoms, which makes there is no cavity for a vacancy-like type of diffusion. So there is only small motion which go upward then and triggers then the whole arrangement. And we talked too much about Eshelby. If you now move this string forward or backwards, and this is just the motion, is more or less this kind of little type of motion here, you have a huge area surrounding that one, which is what we discussed during the conference and also here many times, is this Eshelby stress in the system, which is the memory of what's going on. So if you push forward, the local stress surrounding this one goes backwards. Actually, the flow of stress is coming back, and then there is a memory to come back into the old position. And so if you fix, for example, what we did with Itamar, fixing one of these atoms, pin it down in the MD simulation, and the whole beta process gets is killed by 2%. So you pin only one of these atoms in a string, and its whole is stopped.
But I guess your question is about strings of arbitrary length.
No, the length scale here in the indium is about 20 atoms. We talked about that in colloidal systems. There might be only a couple of atoms actually. The strings there might be, it depends from system to system.
I just was wondering if the type of A and B glasses, they don't look different to me.
Yes.
They look like you just shift to the other time scale. I think if you think of it as two
length,
time scales,
we call
or
them
length scales, either way.
Yes.
I just shifted one of them.
Yes.
So there's anything inherently different between the two. Okay.
No.
Then I understand.
Sorry. Okay. I want to make one more point for the experimentalists here. As I made in the beginning for stress and strain-driven systems, now we have mechanical versus thermal noise. We had a long discussions here from our friends here, the Jean-Louis Barras group. If you do a creep measurement, and we'll do a creep measurement in the future, is actually show you that we apply a certain stress, wait for a certain time, come down again to stress zero and wait for the recovery. So one system is just as mechanically activated, more or less, and at one point you just wait until the system relaxes by temperature. Normally you would say, okay, there's an elastic jump in the strain, and you wait for a certain time, depending on your, what we call sometimes delay time, which is just a time where it reaches some kind of equilibrium, which is a matter of the loss which you have in the system, how much you dissipate in the system. It takes a certain time, you wait, and it comes back and should be the same one. In a system which has no dissipation, these two curves are the same. Later on, I'll show you that on this flank, we see the avalanches, on that one, we don't. So the avalanches, which we discuss later on, actually, Kari knows the results, is actually only measured during creep. Whenever you do it actually in recovery mode, purely thermal, there are no avalanches. At least we don't see any. The same is true for indentation. I mentioned in the beginning, you can also make an indentation measurement. You put in really an indenter in the sample and measure then how much you go inside to measure something like a hardness or modulus as well. Going in, there are pop-ins, jumps. Going out, there are none. Okay, so the system behaves very different under stress, mechanical stress, and only thermal.
This all has to depend on the strain altitude too, right? So you're in a regime where you recover almost everything, or?
That's below. I come to that, where it is actually. It's below. Let me. What time do we need time?
We have a total, including discussion, 45 minutes.
Oh, so we have some time. Okay, great. So. Answer your question first. Well, don't jump too much, okay? Remember your question, we come again. I'm sorry, but let's go through this now if you have some time. So you can measure now the pure beta relaxation, just is everything is below TG, so we see only secondary Heyer-Goldstein mode actually here. And we measure the delay time is something like the loss, and then it's versus temperature and minimal stress. You measure this one. If you now apply a certain stress on the sample and have a fixed temperature, then you can see how it actually looks like in this three-dimensional picture of stresses versus temperature, and this is the losses. So your loss, if you go along a certain line here at fixed temperature, has a certain time scale also on that, which is the delay time. The losses, so to speak, the log of loss versus stresses at fixed temperature, you have a certain curvature. And in this kind of apparent activation volume, we calculate by this simple formula how much you actually have volume activated for that process. And you can see it slows down here, and it jumps over here, and it goes here, even sculpts down again, so this is slope. This is put it over here, and you put real numbers in, you find that you string volume, since you are below TG, where the alpha process is frozen out, we don't only have secondary relaxation process. We find a volume of about 0.4 nanometer cube, which is about 20 to 30 atoms. Exactly what also people saw in the simulations, in the diffusion measurements, and also in some kind of surface measurements from the Japanese group. So that is the volume we talk about in these strings, like a factor of 20 smaller than what we call the plastic events. We have a very plastic, in the simulations at least, we have a very plastic core and some kind of elastic shell surrounding that, Stefan Meyer's work, and you get 20 atoms. Or if you do it mechanically measurements, real measurements, the size is much bigger, but you include a much larger size, obviously, of the stress field, including this apparent volume measurements.
For the simulations, are those actual displacements in the particles, or are they inferring something from the inherent structures?
They show the displacement of the particles above a certain threshold for limited temperature, and only those are plotted here. Okay. You can look at all actually.
But these are simulations also done with
CRISP? No, this is just simulations without any. Okay, I showed you that. I skip this pinning part and come to the avalanches. So now we're doing this, we did these kind of creep measurements all the time because we want to see how it looks like in the volume activation. And during this measurement, we saw this is just the length versus time for a certain sample again. We saw that they have some jumps in the system. Now I have to explain to you what is so different from what the modeling is doing. We have a minimal resolution of our crackling noise of 50 nanometers. The machine is not able to measure lower changes in the length scale, in the absolute length scale, of less than 50 nanometers. We do have the atomic force microscope, and we do have actually a second machine which has a resolution of 1 nanometer. But Robert Ecke, who was here, also we talked privately a bit, and also he said in his talk, it's very hard to see the difference between the bus which passes by, the room motion, and everything else from this comes from the apparatus versus the real crackling noise. So a high resolution, we have tons of data for 1 nanometer resolution, and with the atomic force microscope, we were not able to really discriminate between those noise which comes from the machine itself and noise which comes from the sample. Here we just have a different idea. We just doesn't say, okay, we measure the slip lengths like Kari did in his mean field model. We just wait a certain time until this event happens. So we analyze this kind of in waiting time. We have the waiting time here for an event, and we say the event takes place if more ups than downs are occurring. Okay, from here as an up, this is our jump of 50 nanometers, and we wait until we have accumulated chain length changes of 50 nanometers before we say, okay, this is a jump. So it's very different from what we heard before, that we see that there is a certain length change and strain jump or stress jump. We have the waiting time analysis.
There is no, there is a fine structure which we don't see in here.
Yes, here's, this is the fine structure. The overall curve looks like that. If you look more closely, you see that. And if you look more closer at that one, and then there is a fine structure. This is a minute, so we have much more fine structure in there.
So again, basically pushing, you indenting your material?
No, we're pulling on it. This is a creep measurement. We stress it once, the sample, and wait. Have a constant stress, and then wait until the sample starts to creep. And the temperature is pretty high for the system, so we are below TG. We don't put that MD simulation on. This was real measurements in the moment. This is MD again. We are not in the regime of serrated flow after the yields point. We are in this region here. So it's not true that there is really an elastic material. There is already, even down here, very low stresses. We see already jumps.
Can you relate it to beta processes?
That's an alpha process, which is the composure of the beta processes, as far as we can see, because we have the length change, and we can recover it to a certain amount. Not all of the jumps are actually can be recovered. Okay, there is some plastic deformation also. We cannot, to answer your question correctly, we cannot say this is actually comes from the beta process or from the alpha process. We have only 50 nanometers resolution, and we can say only, I can give you a number of how many plastic events, STCs, must happen before such a length change takes place. So if you look, and we're doing it also now for the MD simulation, if we look over here and get the statistics over there in this so-called plastic regime, we find many events. Clifford Meyer did it already some years ago. So this is a local picture now. And we see locally the stress is increasing. Sorry, this is in German. And then there is a stress drop locally.
So this is
locally inside the MD simulation, in the simulation. Yeah, it's a simulation. Stress drops.
But this is driven differently, because in your case, the stress is fixed.
In our case, the stress is fixed. This is driven differently. This is changed in the affine and non-affine way, the shielding the box. You know? And then they see that, actually.
But this is not a creep thing, is it?
That's not a creep thing. That is really, it's really it's one
just a
fixed strain, and then,
yeah,
it's different.
At finer temperature.
And at finer temperature. And you see the numbers are very high. I don't think the numbers are really important here. It's more or less that there is some kind of a stress drop locally inside this matrix, as we saw it before. Now, what we're doing right now, to tell you that also, is measuring, looking for the motifs which are prior to the jump and after the jump. You ask for actually what is going on locally, okay? So the motifs which we form under stress locally, and then see how they change after the stress drop.
Is this in the beginning loading state?
Yes, it is below critical yield strain.
Yeah. Okay.
So there is almost no real elastic region in the metallic glass. They are all starting to event. It just depends on the time. When you measure very slowly, you find a linear curve, more or less, like most people did. If you do it fast enough, you will see that there's activation going on, and this activation has a time scale, the beta process, I showed it to you, or the temperature scale.
Do you think that's special to metallic glasses, or that's true for all amorphous systems?
Okay. I'm with you. So I had a long discussion here again with Takeshi Egami, and I think the two of us are agreeing that there is almost no elasticity in a disordered system.
Okay, it's settled.
Huh?
It's settled.
It's settled. I don't know. Maybe to you, but not maybe to everybody. so it's, which is a problem for all kinds of other system problems. The material scientists, engineers, they talk about wear, and they talk about fatigue, they talk about crack propagation, crack formation actually, and all these things in the real systems, and how far is elasticity going on actually, and it seems to be very limited. What was your question? I forgot it though.
A long time ago, I asked about the strain amplitude and the creep, and you just answered it. You're well below yield.
Yes, I see.
If you, how big are your avalanches if you go closer to this yield point?
Okay, we come to that. Thank you for the question. Now this is Karin's plot here, from the Nature paper. And so what we're doing first is we're going very much down here in the regime stress strain curve, the so-called linear part, and then we have different parts over there. And she got this mean field result. I don't have to explain it to you. It's minus 1.5. And the cutoff is coming closer to the yield stress, so yield force in her case. Okay. So we did the same now with the waiting time analysis. And what we see is actually not so much. There is only limited time in the beginning. We have only two or three decades, actually. That's very limited data. I have to apologize for that. But it looks like we get this minus 1.5, and we get the cutoff. And here you can see these absolute numbers. But we come close to the yield stress already, and we cut off then these waiting times. We're coming closer to the yield stress. There are more events. The time, the waiting time, which is put it down here, is getting shorter and shorter. And then you can get the cutoff
early. This is a very confusing, so Karin has spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the distribution could look like if you've been at different levels of stress. And this is it's a very strange loading mode that you're in, because you're putting it in creep near the yield, but at different times during the creeping,
yes,
it's going to be behaving differently.
In your case, right?
And I show you where we really differ. You know the data, right? This is just for a certain time measurement, and that's fine.
But when you're doing the statistics, you put on the load, and then throughout the duration of the creep, you take statistics for
yes.
the whole duration of the creep.
Yes, exactly.
Well, you have it on half a decade once.
Yeah, it's already. But what now? Okay. Now we went up a bit higher in temperature, closer to the glass transition temperature. And what we observe here is what we think is a kind of a crossover from one type of deformation to the other one. Again, in the beginning, and this 90 minutes is just a number for this time of temperature, the temperature is not even shown here, there is different numbers in the meantime, and that doesn't matter much. So what we see is, again, this is a full curve of all our results, and we split it up into two different ones, the blue and the red one. More or less artificially, where we think the plots are going okay. In the very beginning, we see again this minus 1.5 or 1.4, whatever you want to call it then, it's around the same number. But we see a clearly different deviation from that plot, okay, from that power law. And waiting times, for long waiting times, near the yield stress, near the glass transition temperature. So it's a mixture of mechanical excitation and thermal excitation. And what we believe, what we see actually is, which is a debate, we can discuss it. I'm happy to get other numbers and other ideas about it. We see here in the mean field idea, we have all these local events, our 50 nanometer events, which can take place more or less randomly. And then we need something which coordinates that into a shear band. We need to have something which are, these quadrupoles which are lining up. We have somehow to align these ones up with a certain critical density, maybe, which are then make a two-dimensional shear band. And what we discuss here, what is the discussion? It's open, actually. I make question mark behind that. that we have from the single events, the single little shearing events, we cross over to a real shear band, to a nano shear band, which is, has then a different power law.
Is there anything special if you look at the creep curves and you look at the strain as a function of time? Is there anything special in
no,
a particular?
No, time? Nothing. Nothing. Of course, this overall length change must bring up again the whole creep curve, right? There's nothing what you can see. And we see, and to make it sure that this is not a. We can see the set-offs. We can see the shear bands with the IFM again, atomic force microscope. We can see actually the cutoffs, the shear offsets of 16 nanometers. We find those ones actually. We find the modulus changes here. I can show you locally how the modulus along the shear band looks like. Okay, here is a very soft region actually. There are regions behind it. It's very clear the shear band localizes. It is a domino part of thing. If one tilts the next one of the metabasin, you're coming down here, this area, you go through areas which are soft ones, under this 45 or something degrees. And you can see also that there is a long range tail of that actually. If you measure now with the nanodendenta, this is a shear band in micrometers here, which is located there, but even far away from that shear band, you see that the hardness, for example, of the modulus is changing too. So the idea, coming back to, to this crossover, which we debated a long time ago, and finally published it also, but it's not solved. It is not system spanning ones like Robert Ecker discussed, because that would show up as a maximum, if I understand it correctly, right? It's, he discussed that for the earthquakes. There is a change in the power law from the normal one, which is mean field discussion we had so often here during the last couple of weeks, to a very different one, which is Alain Lemaître tells me that this is a shear band, then, but unfortunately he's not here.
So are you saying if you actually look at what happens in the sample, can you start seeing the shear bands after 90 minutes?
Well, we have no tools on doing that. We cannot post-mortem. We cannot do it in situ. I mean, look at that.
Yeah.
The offsets can we only see the 15 nanometer offsets which come out at the end of the sample. We can see it later on,
yeah,
but not during the creep test.
But if you compare the sample, if you would take it out before 90 minutes and look at it and
yes,
compare it with after
yes,
90 minutes.
Yes, that's what we have done. There's those offsets. We don't see any offsets for the 90 minutes before that. This 90 minutes is just an arbitrary number, right? I mean, before and after. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that we have these local random orientated ones, and then they form this shear band. Whether that is true or not, I don't know. And we had a discussion before, right, in several occasions. So it's still an open question for me. But it would be very interesting to see and learn more about this crossover. Do we reach a critical density of these kind of local events, and then they interact due to the Escherby stress field into a coordinated, almost synchronized way, or is it just a domino effect, which you tilt one, the next one is tilted, and so on, and you go on?
So, I mean, you said you're near TG and you're near the yield stress.
Yes.
So which one of those is, I mean, could you go well below TG and see the same sort of thing?
We didn't. If we go well below TG, we don't see it. That is what the data I showed you before.
And Jan, second, how this crossover time scale here changes this crossover time scale here?
Okay, we're doing it right now. We try to see whether this scale somehow with the Fourier-Taman law, this kind of alpha excitation process. Okay.
And how does it change? So you have an implied stress, right?
It's yes.
If you make
the stress lower, then we see the avalanches the way we showed before. We see only those. If we go down in temperature, if we go down in stresses, down temperature, we see that the cutoff. So somehow the system changes its modes of flow, is my idea actually.
So
there is a kind of this random localized plastic events, and then they coordinate.
So So the plot that you showed us with the crossover, for which stress was that on this plot?
I have to look it up. I don't know. But somehow near the yield stress up here.
This is waiting time or is
that waiting time. Waiting
time. It's not jump sizes.
No, no.
It has nothing to do with avalanche sizes usually.
It's not obvious.
It's the avalanche. Well, we wait
waiting
for
waiting time.
It's true, but if you had a big event, it's not unlikely that, you know, that you could you've relaxed it for a little bit. Or
you should have. No, no, the idea is the waiting time is actually is reduced, okay, to certain numbers up here for a normal event, okay? If we have now a coordinate event, this takes much longer to take its place, okay? So the idea is long waiting times means for a coordinated corporate shear band motion, which takes place then, takes much longer to wait for that. I don't know.
there's no reason at all to compare to avalanche size distribution with mean field law.
Waiting times.
No, it's not obvious, because if you have a large avalanche, you can ask it, do you expect a large waiting time to trigger the next thing after you've had a big
avalanche? No, a large avalanche would be a succession of steps.
That's fine. Then the succession of steps we see a large avalanche, that would mean a short waiting time.
I think one interesting thing that could be done, this is an idea that came out of a geophysics journal club that I sat yesterday, is okay. That you pick only those avalanches with between two size thresholds, let's say between like 100 and 1,000, and then look at the waiting time distribution between only those avalanches and see if you still get the same collapse. I think that would be an interesting thing to do.
Okay, if I understand you correctly, you mean our binning is actually these 50 nanometers of the machine resolution. If we say, okay, we could bin, for example, other avalanches, we find maybe different distribution in the waiting time. That's what you meant?
Like you, instead of looking at all the avalanches, you only look at those avalanches lying within a certain range of sizes.
Then we
look at the waiting time.
But then we need the resolution of the different steps, and then we do the normal thing, okay? We have a certain waiting time and wait for a certain avalanches. Anyway, that's too far as we can get in the moment. Let me try to summarize that also up. Well, we think that we see the bit relaxations as these most fundamental excitations in disordered systems, which not speaking about the cage breaking stuff. The cage breaking stuff is in picoseconds. At least from the simulations, we know that they have a cage and the atoms move only a little bit to make from a nine-fold next neighbor shift to a 10-fold one, or so. Like Takeshi is discussing that, and this is most of the time is reversible. So these are the ones which are then change the configuration. Or on its way, actually, or make diffusion possible, or make aging, or make then the rejuvenation also. And this, in the bipolar glasses, we think we have that of a size of 20 to 30 atoms, at least a factor less than these plastic events. And they line up for diffusion. I didn't show you that for the small atoms, how this register works. Pinning center, Itamar showed a little bit of this work in his talk during the conference. And the crackling noise analysis gives you at least these statistics similar to the small avalanches. And then if you calculate how much slip you have for one in one dimension of an avalanche of this size, we need about 300 in a row, which is a quite a lot, big number already for making 50 nanometers avalanches. And then the avalanche cross over to really nano shear band. Okay, that's it. Thanks very much. Entropy is a real question, whether the potential energy landscape can be used for entropy, for the different distributions, for the different metabasins actually, and how you change, for example, if you say thermal versus non-thermal. In one case, you jump out of one metabasin into a phase space which has many of those, right? You go jump up. It's like jumping up in temperature is very different heating rates, it is very different necessary to make to avoid crystallization and cooling rates.
Right.
Okay.
It seems like you could
answer this from symmetry.
Simulations. I mean, you know, the difference, the barrier that it takes for that long chain to move, it's one little step.
Yeah.
That barrier seems very small
yeah.
compared to the amount of time it takes for it to actually happen. Well, what's taking so long is getting everybody lined up. It's the entropy of that move that takes
so long.
It's
also related to all these questions we had about soft spots. So if you say that you ask, what are the fundamental relaxation when I deform the material or when I have thermal fluctuations? And people say, well, you look at the eigenvalues of the dynamical matrix. And so the question is basically what temperature you're at. Are you at temperatures where the modes of the dynamical matrix can represent the relaxations or not? And it seems like Jean-Louis may have a comment on this. Or have you mostly focused on sort of zero temperature?
I look at mostly at zero
temperature. But I think in that, and the figure that you put up,
yeah.
it's a very one-dimensional picture.
Yeah, yeah,
the
absolutely.
Only way you can get from one point to the other in that landscape is to go over a barrier.
Right.
If you draw it in higher dimensions, you can go around the barriers.
That's so, the entropy question again.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's what I meant. Okay, if you jump upwards or you jump downwards, mechanically or thermal, actually. If you jump upwards, you have from one meta basin, you jump up into very many configurations of space. Okay, there's many of those little configurations. And if you jump downward, you cool down. You jump, fix the disk position in a very fast quench, or in the simulation at least, you just go down in one meta basin, which is just that one which happens to be just formed. Okay, so there is actually a difference, a symmetry between up jumps and down jumps.
I'm a little bit dubious about your claim that an STC needs to contain like hundreds of.
No. That's I said in the beginning, we had a discussion in this room 4 years ago what we claim is an STC
right,
and what we claim is a plastic event. And I'm claiming here this is in sometimes in this wording is wrong in the sense in yours and Jim Langer's STC model that is very four atoms, right? Which change the configuration locally or small amounts.
I think there are other people claim that
you don't talk about STCs here.
Like 20, 30 atoms, there are other people make this claim. And I would, of course, it's a matter of how you define an STC, but.
You didn't talk about
But I think STCs
yes.
can also account for. Things like stretch exponential relaxation. So
say that the plastic event. It's a different story. Yeah.
I was wondering if in your creep experiment, if you actually did an extended scratch instead of having a local poke in your material, then would you have any chance to observe spatial fluctuations in the in the relaxation, maybe collecting information about size of the events?
No, we haven't done that, actually. That's a good idea to have locally a notch or something in the sample to activate in certain regions with higher stresses. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, if you scratch, say, on a little line and then you keep scanning this line,
okay.
then you might have spatial fluctuations in the
What we did is only the one which is here plotted the afterwards. We looked for a shear band and looked and with the AFRFAM technique, what is the local modulus actually allows that. We define it here, okay, this shear offset, and then we can look around what is the local modulus there. It's not that easy because of this shear offset. We have to find an area where you have really no contact to the next higher step, okay, there is a problem with the tip of the AFM. It's a technical problem.
Can we come back to your creep experiment?
Yes.
What exactly, why do you call these jumps avalanches? What relation do they have to the avalanches that one sees in the programs? So you have jumps in the lens, but how does this relate to
well, so that's the point. We cannot do the statistics of those systems here by different length scale jumps, okay? I mean, normally you would do, if you follow Karin's suggestions, then you would say, okay, what kind of slip lengths you have for different stress. And this is limited in our case mechanically to that kind of resolution. So the idea could be, okay, you take this kind of steps and call that one avalanche if you bin it this way. Okay, that's possible. But we thought, okay, if you wait for a certain time for an event and then look for the distribution of the, so the smaller events, the one slip event, the 50 nanometer events, they will occur more often or more different. If you pull very hard in the beginning, then it says the system creeps and relaxes the stress, actually, the internal stress, by these jumps. And so we just try to see whether this kind of waiting time analysis is gives you some ideas about the power loss as well. It doesn't say that this waiting time, any waiting time for an event, is not give you not the size of the slip.
Okay, that's a standard
mean. You talk about Barkhausen jumps. How should I compare this with Barkhausen?
Okay, from the statistics of the waiting times. Statistics of the waiting times is like you pull on the you pull on your the magnetic system and wait until the domain was de-pin. Okay, and there is a mechanic in the magnetic case. There's also creep. You have a creep relaxation if you excite the external field to a certain value and wait for the system to creep into that one. You hear also the same kind of noise from the creep experiments.
In the classical Barkhausen noise analysis, you don't look at waiting time. You look at distribution of size of avalanche,
yes.
Distribution of duration of avalanche. And I'm not even scaling between both, and I'm not even sure you respect confirm Mikai polar distribution of waiting time for
waiting time is a Poissonian process.
So the classical back
is not. It's not.
In the mean field model, if you modify your model and put, I don't know what it's a memory kernel, then of course
so it's
non mean field. If you have a mean field model to which he is comparing, then
no, I think there may be an argument to say that his waiting times are following the same scaling law. If you basically, for example, think about the magnets. If you have long-range forces, you could imagine if you have a demagnetizing field, you could imagine that if you have a large avalanche, it you know you have to wait a long time because you just relaxed a lot of the field. You have to wait a long time until you trigger the next one.
This is not the main entry one.
Well, he's just looking at, he's not talking about any model, he's just representing his results and saying, looking at the waiting times,
it's
interesting.
He's comparing to a model which
we
has the waiting times.
We saw in the beginning there's a Poisson distribution, okay? We thought that it would come out, actually. And the results is, it's not.
Yeah, but the point is that it's not, because you have this interesting observation that it tells you it's a Barkhausen noise. It's nothing to do with that.
It's not obvious. I think it's not obvious.
I mean, we have to run a simulation with this process, I mean, the mean field process, and then there's a coarse graining step in there, and then one has to resample this and check what comes out. I did do this exercise.
Yeah, we talked about that already a year ago, and yeah.
Well, then, okay, I mean, if you present this data, you need to check that this is, has anything to do.
No,
at least on this mean field process.
It's perfectly legitimate to show the results and to say intuitively you might expect waiting time statistics.
No, intuitively, I know there are
some. Okay. But we are not only simple. Why don't you just look at the distribution of jumps?
Because they are limited. They are limited by all the resolution. Okay. And if you have that, this kind of, if you call this a jump, this is 15 meters, this is a jump, and this is a jump.
So your jumps are 15.
Then we have all the 15. That's not what we want. We then have to say, okay, we must. That's what the idea. We bin those into 15 nanometer jumps and wait until the time. So we call that not a large avalanche. We call that a different waiting time. It's good to see that. Yes.
Yeah.
All
right. So maybe let's thank him again for a great talk.